morning of the 3rd of January 2026, US Army Delta Force successfully carried out a daring operation in Caracas, capturing Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and spiriting him away to the United States. The stunning dawn raid shocked observers around the world. In one fell swoop, the Trump administration signaled its intention to pursue a more assertive geopolitical strategy in Latin America and the Western Hemisphere. This new hemispheric vision, christened as the Donroe Doctrine, seeks to reshape Washington's near abroad, and it isn't afraid to use military might in pursuit of this ambition. Following the coup in Caracas, Trump and his administration have now set their sights on another long-running American adversary, the communist regime in Cuba. Since January, the president has imposed punishing sanctions and tariffs on the country, along with an oil blockade, to ramp up pressure on the Cuban government and bring it to heel. What happens next and where does it all lead? Can the Cuban regime be tamed using the same playbook deployed in Venezuela? And will the Trump administration succeed in its quest to reshape the Western Hemisphere? I'm Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. With me to discuss the Trump administration's plans in Venezuela and Cuba is Joseph Ledford, fellow at the Hoover Institution of Stanford University. A warm welcome to the podcast, Joseph.
Thank you, Jack. It's good to be here, some 8,500 kilometers from the Stanford campus, but I'm happy to report the weather is very similar to San Francisco, so not too much of a change.
Well, that is a unique set of circumstances, so we're delighted to welcome you to a sunny London for a change. Don't expect this every time, Joseph. Now, Joseph, we're here to discuss a marvelous essay that you have written for Engelsberg Ideas, which our listeners can find on the app and via the website. In the article, you describe a paradigm shift that has taken place in the United States' approach to the Western Hemisphere under the Trump administration. Can you explain what that shift looks like and why it is so significant in your estimation?
Great question. In particular, the paradigm shift that I discuss in the essay has to do with and what was in the past a law enforcement-only strategy towards transnational criminal organizations. And here I'm talking about drug cartels, gangs, namely the Sinaloa cartel, but the other gangs and cartels throughout the region that have been classified as foreign terrorist organizations. And the FTO designation created a paradigm shift because the Trump administration had decided that the law enforcement-only strategy had failed. So the entire shift in national security policy for the United States, which is outlined in the national security strategy, subsequently in the national defense strategy, aims to use lethal force towards drug cartels. And this leads into what we'll discuss today with Operation Absolute Resolve and the Cuban regime is the United States also uses those air and naval assets that have been built up in the Southern Caribbean to address those foreign terrorist organizations to deal with hostile state actors. So the paradigm shift is that the United States now has tasked the Pentagon with dealing with drug cartels as well as hostile states.
And this new approach has been described by various members of the administration in various ways. So you have the Donroe Doctrine, famously from the president himself, but you also have Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, expressing this idea of a greater North America or a homeland security perimeter. Mm. Can you just explain what the contours of this new strategy are and what the administration is attempting to do with it?
Yes, another great question, which is a corollary to the shift in addressing transnational criminal organizations, is a capacious definition of homeland security and homeland defense, which started day one. I would direct listeners to look at the slew of executive orders that President Trump signed on January 20th, 2025, along with those FTO designations, was an executive order that declared that the primary mission of the U.S. Armed Forces is homeland defense. Now, what's interesting about homeland defense and what Pete Hegseth recently articulated to our Latin American neighbors is this concept of greater North America, in which the Trump administration is circumscribing chief responsibility to the United States, to this region that stretches from Greenland to the equator. And then below the equator, the Amazon, the Andes, Latin American countries will burden share part of the defense. Now, this is not new. And as I discuss in the essay, this was FDR's conception of homeland defense, and or hemispheric defense, rather, that developed out of the Good Neighbor Policy in the 1930s and the run-up to World War II. What's different in the Trump administration is the technology, the types of assets that are being deployed, but in terms of the strategy, it's the same, that the United States will use military force for against both internal and external actors aimed to spread malign influence and inflict damage on the Western Hemisphere.
I'd like to pick up on what you said about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, because a lot of observers have seen what the Trump administration did in Venezuela, and they've actually invoked another Roosevelt, his fifth cousin and President Theodore Roosevelt, and particularly Theodore Roosevelt's more assertive reinterpretation of the Monroe Doctrine, dare I say it, an imperialist interpretation of the Monroe Doctrine. And these critics have often said that the Trump administration is attempting to revive that approach.
Right.
But I think one of the interesting suggestions in your article for Engelsberg Ideas is that there is perhaps a more benign impulse. Can you just tell us a little bit more about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's good neighbor policy and what the Trump administration is seeking to revive from it?
Yes. First, let me address TR. I want to perhaps deploy some revisionist history here, and a shout out to Sean Mirsky's recent book, because he talks about this. Yes, TR developed the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which inverted its purposes to exercise police power, because TR was concerned about European powers, namely Britain, coming to collect debts from Caribbean nations, and that it would be the United States' responsibility. But TR receives a bad reputation for this. It was his progressive successors that intervened more than he did in the Caribbean. Theodore Roosevelt operated the customs houses, and he did install a new government under the Platt Amendment in Cuba. But other than that, there was not a lot of intervention under Theodore Roosevelt. Subsequently, his cousin, FDR, sought to build a hemispheric-wide coalition, obviously the Good Neighbor Policy, and in fact articulated this in a 1929 article for Foreign Affairs, I believe it was 1929 before he was governor of New York, in which he repudiated the progressive impulse to intervene in Latin America, which were the progressive successors of his cousin, and instead thought to bolster U.S. presence in the hemisphere by building diplomatic and economic relationships. It may seem counterintuitive, given the communication skills of the Trump administration, but this is certainly the case that I see from the Trump administration. It's a lot more muscular. It has the rhetorical flair of a Roosevelt corollary, but there's a good neighbor policy logic to it. And here I would reference the first trip abroad from Marco Rubio was to Central America. That was the first time a Secretary of State had visited Central America for his first trip abroad since 1912. Philander Knox and the Taft administration because of the Panama Canal. The administration has its two chief diplomats, Rubio and then the Deputy Secretary of State, Christopher Landau, a Latin American specialist. It's the first time in American history that our two chief diplomats are bilingual in Spanish. It's a priority of the administration. If you look at the bilateral deals that have been secured in the region, it follows a diplomatic and economic logic. There's now the Shield of Americas, which I discuss in my essay, which is a multinational military partnership that has a diplomatic component to it. The administration is trying to seek a multilateral response to the issues in the hemisphere, which are first and foremost transnational criminal organizations, but also dealing with those lingering hostile states, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, which are a thorn in the side for most of the countries in the region. They have very few friends outside of Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia.
So is there an appetite for this among Latin American governments? Is there a sense that this change in the administration's posture or the change in the U.S.'s approach to Latin America has been a long time in coming?
I think for many governments, it's a good news, bad news situation. And I'll add a caveat that part of what is helping the Trump administration's approach are dynamics within Latin America that the United States has nothing to do with, which is namely the ebbing of the pink tide. There is a rise of centrist and conservative governments in Latin America because the leftist governments that were swept into power failed to deliver. And part of that has to do with security. And that is downstream from the failure of the region to deal with the problem in Venezuela and the Maduro regime until the Trump administration. The migration crisis caused by the Maduro regime and the subsequent rise of transnational criminal organizations has given rise to new governments that are eager to meet Washington's demand. The biggest countries in the region are still governed by ostensibly leftist governments that are very critical of the U.S. in public, but behind closed doors, not so much. We could talk about that later if you want. But Latin America, I think, has been hungry for the United States to be a good neighbor. Part of the reason that Latin American governments rely on Chinese capital investment is because the United States did not provide a viable alternative. We would give lip service to our region mattering, but now it's more than lip service, and I think it's incumbent on American policymakers to deliver. If we're going to say that our neighbors should not engage with the Chinese Communist Party, then we have to be there for them as well. So on the one hand, many governments in the region are eager for the United States to be involved and are eager to cooperate with the United States, but there is some trepidation that is this for the long term?
And on the side of the Trump administration and several members of his administration who you've mentioned, there does seem to be a real urgency about their policy and their approach to Latin America and the broader Western Hemisphere. Where does that urgency come from? You've mentioned the desire to really clamp down on drugs trafficking and criminal cartels. Is China also in the picture, the desire to compete with China and perceived advance for Chinese interests in Latin America?
Yes. I will direct listeners to Donald Trump's speech announcing his presidency over 10 years ago, descending the golden escalator. He's not talking about Latin America in a grand strategic sense, but if you think about the issues that have been core to his political program from the outset, drugs, crime, migration, China, where do those issues radiate and where do they really matter? In the Western Hemisphere, he doesn't always articulate it that way, even though many in his administration now do, but those are key to him. And then beyond Rubio and Chris Landau, who I've already mentioned, Susie Wiles comes out of Florida politics, Stephen Miller, who very much has an interest in Latin America, Pete Hegseth himself, someone who's been chastened by adventures in the Middle East, even though we're now involved in another one, has a great interest in greater North America, but also in Latin America. So there's personnel as policy. So a lot of the urgency comes from there is a cohesion within the administration. And here I'll name drop John Ratcliffe, the director of CIA, who has the same view. So there is an orientation in this administration towards the Western Hemisphere that we have not seen for quite some time, maybe since George W. Bush or even earlier, the Reagan administration. There's a sense of urgency because the lead policymakers think the region matters for great power competition. Because I often have said in public and in private, for that matter, what is even the point of great power competition if the United States cannot extirpate China's malign influence in our own backyard? The irony has been that the lack of focus on the region has coincided with the intensifying of great power competition. And if you look at Chinese investment in the region and Chinese involvement in the region since the rise of Xi Jinping coming to power, it has been enormous.
So this is really a long overdue change, in your opinion?
Yes. And from the national security perspective, way overdue. We're going to talk about Cuba, but I'll give a nice lead in here. The Chinese Communist Party have supplanted Russia as the patrons of Cuba, insofar as they now operate 4 signal intelligence bases to spy on our space industry, on our maritime shipping, on finance, regular citizens in South Florida. They are trying to access dual-use space infrastructure in Latin America to hack satellites and to deploy. Anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah. That does lead very nicely on to what I want to ask you about next, which is the US's relations with Cuba and Venezuela. Could you just touch briefly on the history of those relationships between the United States on the one hand and Cuba and Venezuela on the other? How have they evolved over the last century or so? Because, you know, it might be easy to assume that they've always been adversarial in right. their relations with the United States, but it was not always so. Is that, would that be fair to say?
That would depend on the perspective. If but we've American policymakers have always had an interest in Cuba. Certainly, then early America, the idea was to annex Cuba, to have Cuba perhaps as a state because of sugar production. The United States was involved in Cuban independence, but we had inserted the Platt Amendment, which TR invoked, which allowed us to install new governments if we deemed so. The United States' commercial interest, political interest in Cuba, Batista, the dictator who assumed power in the early 50s, was Washington's man in Havana, who obviously was overthrown by Fidel Castro in the Cuban Revolution in January 1959, which really sparks the tense relationship that we're discussing today. Of course, no one needs to be reminded that the entire world was nearly annihilated because of Cuba. We went to the nuclear brink over Nikita Khrushchev's decision to station nuclear weapons there, which, by the way, Fidel Castro, we found out decades later, advocated him using on the United States. So the animosity has always been there, and the relationship throughout the Cold War was one of an adversarial relationship. Cuba has always been a small power that boxes in the heavyweight division. This is with their use of espionage. I mean, they are the kings of counterintelligence. They've placed high-level spies within the United States government who have operated for decades. We have several instances of those spies being in the State Department and the DIA, passing secrets. The Cubans were the revolutionary proxy force of the Soviet Union, fomenting disorder in Latin America and Africa. They have been the chief opponent of the United States advancing its interests in the Western Hemisphere since January of 1959. Now, of course, that has been complicated by the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Cuba entered what was called the special period in the 1990s. A lot of poverty, deprivation, a lack of Soviet subsidies, some reforms in Cuba, most notably the rise of the GAESA, which is the military conglomerate that essentially runs the Cuban economy. Raul Castro constructed that in the 1990s. And the reason that is important when we discuss how you could actually engineer regime change in Cuba, that creates quite a problem. More recently, to resolve this Cuba issue, is that there have been attempts at both carrot and stick of dealing with Cuba to try to moderate the regime or change the regime. During the Obama administration, there was a normalization of relations. The idea behind that was that the United States would directly engage the people of Cuba, try to open the economy, thinking that the free flow of people and capital would somehow induce the regime to change after Fidel Castro had relinquished power to his brother and was elderly and was kind of sidelined, that Raul would be a little bit more moderate and understanding and want the regime to survive. Of course, all he did was just use it to the Cuban Communist Party's advantage. Then comes Donald Trump's first term, which sweeps away all of the normalization and ratchets up the sanctions and the tension. Here, what's important is he removed the suspension on Title III of the Helms-Burton Act from 1996, which allowed those who had their property confiscated to sue individuals and companies in courts for using their property. So now we have two cases in front of the Supreme Court over that. He imposed sanctions. He created a restricted economic list, on and on and on. And so then here comes the Biden administration. The Biden administration revokes about half of it. It's not complete normalization, but it's moving towards that. But that was a short period. Now Trump 2.0, it's maximum pressure again. On the Venezuelan side, relations were not always that strained until 27 years ago, the rise of the Bolivarian Revolution and Hugo Chavez, which, by the way, Fidel Castro had a hand in building his security apparatus and creating what ultimately became the Chavez regime and the Maduro regime, in which there was a similar tense relationship between Hugo Chavez and the United States. And over time, that intensified, that worsened. Hugo Chavez dies, Maduro comes to power in 2013, and the relationship worsens. And the United States, under the Obama administration, did not take a maximum pressure stance that Trump did during his first term, in which there was attempts at regime change and attempts at supporting the democratic opposition and attempts to impose more sanctions. Ultimately, I think the COVID-19 epidemic thwarted what would have been a much more intense, proactive policy from the Trump administration. The Biden administration tried a carrot and stick approach to allow for democratic elections, which took place. The opposition won overwhelmingly, and Maduro stole the election, and the Biden administration did nothing. And then Trump 2.0, which leads me to tie these two together, which, as you can tell from my brief overview, Joseph's Wikipedia, that the United States has had longstanding business between the regimes in Venezuela and Cuba. And Donald Trump, coming in his second term, looking to make his legacy, has decided that he is going to settle all accounts. And this is not just in the Western Hemisphere, as we see what's happening in the Middle East, that the United States has too many enemies and some need to be taken off the board. And so when you asked earlier about what the urgency is, I think from the president himself, as he realizes, one, many of America's enemies, or enemies of the West in general, are paper tigers. And two, we can do something about it, and that we have the capabilities, certainly now, to do so.
And there is a sense that there's a link between Venezuela and Cuba and the regimes in those two countries, and that in order to deal with one of them, you have to deal with both of them. Would you say that's a fair reflection of the administration's thinking?
Absolutely. Partly, as Secretary Rubio has said, Cuba colonized Venezuela. They built the security services. They did the same in Nicaragua, too. They advised the regime. They had an oil for security services and medical support. Cuba deploys doctors as part of their diplomacy, but it's really a facade to then bring in security services. And so they monitored the regime, they provided political advice, security services. In fact, many, I think 32 Cubans were killed during Operation Absolute Resolve, or at least 32 is what the Cuban government said, so it could be 65. But yes, and so from the administration standpoint, you remove the Maduro regime, not only do you remove the principal malfeasant in the region for being a hub for China, Russia, and Iran, but you also remove the lifeline for the Cuban regime. Because of the advent of the maximum pressure campaign and the sanctions, Cuba is really reeling. But then also now they're not receiving the oil from their patron. And so the Cuban regime would provide the security services and Venezuelan oil would go to Cuba. And so if you could remove the link, then it isolates Cuba further, because the administration's logic is China and Russia, for various reasons, are not willing to go to the brink over Cuba now. We'll see if that plays out, because the Russians did send one tanker of oil that the administration allowed through. But the administration's thinking was, if you remove the Maduro regime, or at least find some regime management in Venezuela, Cuba's isolated.
So take us through the administration's recent, very dramatic intervention in Venezuela. As you put it, to decapitate the head of the regime, Nicolas Maduro, in early January. Was this something that the Trump administration had been planning for a long time, or was it a course of action that was settled on at a relatively late date?
It was both. Let me explain. Donald Trump had tried for at least 9 months leading up to perhaps longer to convince Nicolas Maduro to leave. He could leave with his family. He could leave with money. I mean, there were various, I don't have complete inside information of what was offered, but from what we do know from the various reports, that Trump would offer charitable deals that ratchet up while he was negotiating with Maduro, while at the same time they built a compound for the Delta Force to practice raids over several months in order to capture Maduro and his wife, who had been indicted in federal court. So while the Trump administration planned Operation Absolute Resolve, which was a joint force operation which included everything from special operations to Space Force. He tried diplomacy, and this follows Trump's. Trump has a template. I think the Iranians discovered this, just like Maduro discovered this, that Trump is willing to make a deal. But if you don't make a deal, he will enforce his red line.
And you describe the operation in Venezuela as a decapitate and delegate operation. It's a kind of attempt at coerced regime management, not regime change. Could you just expand a little bit on what you mean by that?
Yes. I will not take credit for that. That came from an unnamed source in the administration. But the idea was based on analysis that came out of the Central Intelligence Agency that a complete, let's say, Iraq war-style regime change of removing everyone in power, purging the security services, and installing Maria Corina Machado in as president would foment disorder, a kind of civil chaos that the administration wasn't really interested in. They didn't want violence in the streets. They didn't want civil war or another migration crisis. So what they determined that based on the power centers within the government, between the security services, the armed forces, and then the vice president and her brothers, the head of the National Assembly, that they could find members of the regime that would be willing to turn on the others and consolidate power so that there is this, quote, pragmatic Chavista that would be willing to avoid prison and engineer a bridge between the regime to a democratic change. And so it is a regime management. So you decapitate, you arrest Maduro and his wife, and you prosecute them in New York. You hang indictments over the others. You have the overwhelming, awesome force of the United States military on display in Operation Absolute Resolve as a way to shatter the psyche of the regime and its supporters. And then you begin to implement what they've called a three-phase process of stabilization, recovery, and transition. I think this is certainly, and I've said so, a product of the Iraq War syndrome, that this concern of like full-scale occupation regime change ends in a quagmire and counterinsurgency and chaos, and that there has to be a more effective way to do this. And I have described this as diplomacy by aircraft carrier.
Right.
It's no longer gunboat diplomacy. Right. We use the Ford Carrier Strike Group, but the United States has a buildup of air and naval assets in the Southern Caribbean. And just like with Iran, we can just sit off the coast and just pummel you with air power, which we have supreme control of the skies, and if necessary, come in and extract you with Delta Force. And so it's disciplining the rogue state. So it's the force from abroad, but then it's also presiding over the oil industry. The Venezuelan state now has to submit monthly budgets to the United States, in which we manage, and treasury accounts. So what we're doing is preventing the payoffs and the corruption that had sustained the Maduro regime. So the stabilization comes first. So the concept behind decapitate and delegate, at least in the Venezuelan case, was that you remove the dictator, and then you find someone within the regime that will engineer a slow transition.
And we haven't seen the kind of fallout and conflict escalation that we've seen playing out in Iran.
Right.
Is there a particular reason why the regime in Venezuela might be particularly amenable or vulnerable to this kind of approach? Is there a reason why this seems to be, dare I say, succeeding,
yes,
at least for now, in Venezuela, whereas it's not succeeding in Iran?
Yes. Context. Venezuela was a democracy up until 27 years ago. Venezuela has a consolidated democratic opposition with a fearless leader who just received the Nobel Prize, who wins in polling, a democratic opposition that wins in elections. And by the way, the reason we know they overwhelmingly win in elections is because Hugo Chavez, when he was winning elections, installed election equipment that has a pretty accurate count. So we know that the democratic opposition won in the last election by overwhelming numbers. So you have at least two generations of Venezuelans that know what the country was like before the Chavistas ruined it. You have a younger generation that understand that it can be a democracy, that have been abroad or have come back. So it's completely separate dynamics. There's not the ethnic conflict. Latin America is not the Middle East. And there's just a host of cultural, social, political reasons of why the Venezuelan state is conducive to this type of decapitate and delegate. Some of it has to do with the regime structure itself of the Chavistas, which is quite different from radical Shiism, corrupt Latin American leftists. Perhaps they're easier to do business with. less suicidal.
Perhaps not as committed to the revolution as regimes elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true, which is not the case in Cuba. It's quite different. They are much more committed, but yeah.
And we'll get on to that difference between Venezuela and Cuba mm-hmm. in a bit. I wonder if you could just run us through what's been happening in Venezuela since early January under Delcy yes. Rodriguez, who yes. has been President Nicolas Maduro's replacement
right.
under American tutelage, as it were.
Yes, Delcy Ping is underway. And by that, I mean like Deng Xiaoping. She is attempting to liberalize economically Venezuela while maintaining tight political control. So it's been a half success insofar as the Trump administration now says, Secretary Rubio says, that stabilization has occurred, and it's about economic recovery and rebuilding civil society. So first, the United States sought to stabilize politically the country. They did not want violence in the streets from security services, the colectivos, gangs. They wanted the trains to run on time, so to speak. While we helped Venezuela rebuild the oil industry. We try to bring investment into the country while we restore diplomatic relations. And many of these things have happened. The embassies have been restored. There's been high-level meetings and delegations, energy Secretary Chris Wright, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, John Ratcliffe, Francis Donovan, the commander of U.S. Southern Command, has met his Venezuelan counterpart. So there's been high-level interactions between the interim government and Washington. So diplomacy is underway, economic recovery is underway, but what is concerning, certainly concerning to me and others who are monitoring the situation, is it looks like the political opening, this transition, the political reconciliation, the rebuilding of civil society is not happening at the same pace. And so it's hard to parse where the emphasis is in Washington because the president speaks about it one way, Secretary Rubio emphasizes the transition aspect. I think they're on the same page. The president is mostly concerned with rebuilding the economy, reviving the oil industry, mining, clamping down on transnational crime, as the Venezuelan state was a facilitator of it. That doesn't seem to be the case now. So there has been incremental progress. And the reason I said Delcy Ping is because you can have that economically. And I think that is much easier than the political part because the interim government thinks that they can outlast the Trump administration. They understand the American political system. We have elections. Trump has 3 years left. The midterms may be particularly bad for the Republican Party, and they're following Fidel Castro's old advice, which is you give just enough to appease Washington, and then eventually Washington gets preoccupied with other matters because we're a global superpower. And so right now, we're at war with Iran. So that is good news for Delcy Rodriguez because she thinks she can use that to her advantage to slow the political transition. Because by delivering economic results, by opening the Venezuelan economy to foreign investment and American investment, she thinks that will please Washington. I'm skeptical because Rubio gave an interview last week in which he was very clear after meeting with Maria Corina Machado that the political transition would come. The question is going to be, can it come fast enough before the United States is preoccupied with something else?
Do you foresee any scenario where the situation in Venezuela might turn into another quagmire for the United States where they have to overinvest more military power just to try and stabilize the country and to facilitate a transition?
I'm not in the prediction game, but right now I would make the argument that there are more positive indications that the political transition can happen, that democracy can be restored. And I use the word restored here rather than imposed or brought about, because democracy existed previously. There was an election in which the opposition won. There is a legitimate government that was prevented from being installed. And so it is more of a democratic restoration. I think it's possible. I think all of the factors are in play. I don't see it descending into violence. In fact, what Delcy Rodriguez is doing, kind of the irony of Delcy Rodriguez replacing the defense minister, replacing members of the government with her preferred personnel or those who Washington has signed off on, which I think is much more likely, is she is making it less likely that there will be political chaos. And that is also important why the United States is dispersing money based on the budgets that are being submitted. So they're able to pay security services, to pay members of the government. And so the instability doesn't come about. But there are still some worrying signs of in the economy. Inflation is incredibly high. These sorts of... I will say this. Let me give one caveat to that. The longer this takes, the more pressure from below that builds. Because it is asking a lot of Venezuelans, who I think, by the way, should be commended for exercising a lot of restraint, rather than taking to the streets in mass protest or allowing the process to play out. But the longer it takes and the more it looks like, oh, it's just the old regime, but with a better economy, then you may lose the transition from below as civil society takes to the streets and is no longer abiding the timeline that Washington is imposing.
So there's a very fine balancing act to be performed, really.
Yes.
I'd like to move on to Cuba now. You describe Venezuela and the intervention there by the Trump administration as a kind of acid test when it comes to regime management. But the real prize in Trump's eyes is Cuba and transforming that U.S.-Cuba relationship. Can you just take us through the plans that the administration has for Cuba and what are the challenges that they face here?
It's hard to parse what the exact plan is, other than we want to change the government in Cuba. In fact, I mentioned earlier the Helms-Burton Act governs U.S.-Cuban relations because we cannot have normalization and the lifting of the embargo, which is codified through the legislation, without a democratic change that does not have a Castro in power, that has free and open elections, that has a free market economy. There's a lot of conditions, but also returns the confiscated property to the exile community. So that gives the Trump administration less room to run than the Venezuelan situation because there are laws in which governs what the Trump administration can do. So far, based on the reporting, based on what we can see, is the Trump administration is trying to find an opening. And part of that is removing the current president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who was handpicked by Raúl Castro, who's really running the regime. The best way to think about the regime in Cuba is less like Venezuela. It's still the Castro family. It's a communist country that's a family business. And key members of the Castro family are involved in the ongoing negotiations. I'll mention one, the crab, Raúl Rodríguez Castro, who's involved, grandson of Raúl Castro, who's head of his personal security services, but also involved in Gaisa, sort of the right-hand man of Raúl, who seems to be, to the Trump administration, a kind of pragmatic alternative. But there are domestic ramifications for this. The exile community is not going to abide a U.S. policy that just changes one Castro for a younger Castro. So there is domestic political pressures to actually have real regime change that does not leave anyone from the Castro administration in power. In practice, this is very difficult, and I think this is the circle the administration is trying to square, is that this is a regime that has been in power since January of 1959. It's a one-party communist state. It's not the Venezuelan case. The military runs most of the economy. There is not a unified political opposition. There is a deep political opposition that are principally based in Florida, but there's not a unifying figure like a Maria Corina Machado. There's the Cuban government obviously doesn't allow a democratic opposition within the country. So it is not quite clear what Trump and Rubio have planned, other than they are trying to, through sheer force and maximum pressure, to open the regime. The Cuban government, for example, said, well, they were going to give amnesty to 2,100, I believe it was 2,100 prisoners. But it turns out they haven't released any political prisoners. It's mostly common criminals, which is a typical tactic from the Castro regime. With that, the Cuban government announced, will allow Cuban nationals living abroad to invest in private businesses in the island. Well, no one can really do that based on how U.S. laws govern it. So there can be no widespread investment, like in the Venezuelan case, because of the U.S. laws, the codified embargo. So the Trump administration, even with executive fiat, if Trump were to waive a lot of the sanctions to provide for some investment like the Obama administration did and Biden tried to do, it still wouldn't bring about the kind of change that the Trump administration wants. And if it sounds like I'm being quite vague, it's because those of us who are outside of the administration aren't quite clear on what the administration is trying to do, because it is such a complicated situation without a root and stem kind of regime change, in which you have to wholesale change the government. Which if you were going to have regime change in Cuba, it would have to be that. I'm very skeptical. I'm not saying it's not impossible that you can have a change in the Cuban political system without a Castro involved that wouldn't essentially be a military dictatorship. Now, the Trump administration may think that is the preferred alternative to the current regime, is that you sideline enough members of the current government and the Castro family to allow the ascent of non-Castro-related figures to run the government. And the last thing I'll note that gives some indication that this could be a possibility is that there was reporting that the U.S. Attorney's Office of Southern Florida is looking to indict members of the regime, similar to Maduro and his wife, for a host of related charges. The representatives, political representatives in Florida, have encouraged the administration to indict Raul Castro for shooting down the Brothers to the Rescue planes in the mid-1990s, which was the inspiration or the fuel behind the Helms-Burton Act, was that three Americans and one U.S. resident were killed by shot down by Cuban jets. And Raul Castro obviously was involved in that. And so it's quite possible that the administration, the fullest expression of the maximum pressure campaign, is it indicts members of the regime at the top to force pragmatic individuals, if they exist, to sideline them in the negotiations. So anyway, sorry for the long digression, but we're looking at more alternatives than a clear plan of what the administration is trying to do, because it's such a tricky situation.
Please don't apologize. We're in favor of long digressions at Engelsberg Ideas. It's what we do. You mentioned the Cuban diaspora in the United States, the exile community. What kind of political influence do they wield in the White House and over the administration? And is it significant that Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, is himself from that heritage? He is from a Cuban-American background.
You could make the case that there is outsized influence. I think some of it is structural, because in the House, there's such a slim Republican majority that Maria Salazar, who is also the head of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee on the House Foreign Affairs, who is obviously vocally and advocates against the Castro regime, is very much in touch with the White House and pushes this, as is the other representatives from Florida. And Rick Scott is very vocal about this in the Senate. So within the Republican Party, not to go through all the names of individuals who don't like the Castro regime, which there are many of them in the Republican Party, this is one issue in which there is a unified opposition that constantly pushes the White House to do more, to do more. Within Miami itself, the Miami-Dade mayor put out a video three or four days ago denouncing the Trump administration's approach to Cuba because the White House has been negotiating with the Castros. So even Democratic Cuban exiles think that the policy hasn't been aggressive enough. Within the White House, what's interesting is, I mentioned Susie Wiles earlier, the president himself is a resident of Florida. The Castro regime has been a target of his for a long time. The same was the case for the regime in Iran. Trump has some views on certain members in the international community that have not changed for decades. And he certainly there is no love lost for the Castro regime outside of it being a perennial problem in American foreign policy that he wants to resolve, as he just personally doesn't like them. Many friends of his are in the exile community in Florida who have, I think, influenced his his view of the Castro regime over time. And it's certainly this, if there was a lifelong goal in politics of Marco Rubio fomenting some kind of regime change in Cuba is one of them. So it is very personal. There's no way to get around that and say it's obviously personal for the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State's not the president. So he ultimately will have to carry out what Donald Trump wants to do. And Trump has a tendency to sway from risk averse to risk on based on the operation. So I would just conclude by saying there's a lot of pressure within the Republican Party from the exile community to change a regime. They think Donald Trump is the man to do it after what the action the United States has taken in Venezuela and Iran, and they see it as a prize. So I think anything is on the table.
And what are the tariffs, sanctions, and blockades that the United States has been imposing on Cuba since January? Can you just tell us more about those and what effect they might be having?
Yes. One thing I would like to clear up is the collapsing energy grid in Cuba has less to do with an oil quarantine and more to do with the neglecting of a dilapidating energy grid from the Soviet era. And Cuba actually has enough domestic production that they could divert to emergency services if they wanted to. But this is the perils of a state-planned economy. It just doesn't work. Cuba could trade with 100-plus countries. I don't know why it always seems that American capital is necessary to make communism work. The Trump administration has imposed, as I said, a maximum pressure campaign with a new emergency declaration that puts tariffs on any third country that tries to ship oil to Cuba. So anyone could send them oil. They just would be tariffed by the United States. There's the Cuban restricted list, the entities that are run by the military conglomerate I was talking about that you can't have any financial transactions with. Remittances are basically down to just mule carriers. Western Union doesn't operate. So it's very difficult to get hard currency into the country. The United States has not, I will say could, but has not deployed secondary sanctions. So one Trump card, so to speak, is that the United States could begin to crack down on Canadian and European tourists and money flowing into the island by deploying secondary sanctions.
I just wonder if you could give us an update on the oil blockade, because there are reports, obviously, that one Russian oil tanker has been allowed to pass through the blockade and dock in Cuba. Does this mean that the blockade is weakening? What's happening there? Why would the Trump administration allow that to happen?
I think it's part of ongoing negotiations. From Trump's perspective, if you follow the way that he negotiates, he always likes to have maximum leverage. And part of showing you have maximum leverage is allowing a little bit of oil in to give a little bit more of a lifeline to the Cuban economy to just turn it off again. And I think this also coincided with the FBI being in Havana based on some American citizens who were engaged in some nefarious activities that had nothing to do with the government, in which they were fired upon by Cuban security services because they were trying to extract people from the island. So the FBI was in the country dealing with Cuban officials to work out the investigation into this. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think all of this is connected to ongoing talks, carrot-stick approach.
And now, if you were a betting man, would you say that we're likely to see a sudden or dramatic intervention this year, perhaps before the midterm elections in November?
I think we're in store for some big moves. Whether that is an Operation Absolute Resolve, I'm less inclined to say that's the case, more of perhaps a diplomatic breakthrough. And I think that's what the Trump administration is looking for, because the last thing they want to do is trigger another migration crisis. In the last 5 years, 15% of the population of Cuba has fled. Also keep in mind the crisis is happening in Haiti next door, which is a subject for perhaps another podcast. But this is not all happening in a vacuum. And then, of course, the war with Iran. I would bet once the war with Iran winds down, the president has given, you know, a 2 to 3 week timeline. I don't know. He keeps changing it. But if that winds down in the near future, I think the attention returns to Cuba in a much more sustained way.
And do you think the course of the war in Iran might give him pause in some aspects in terms of how he approaches Cuba and these negotiations in Cuba?
Of course, it all affects, in the aggregate, of the president's decision about what actions he takes. Do I think if the course of the war in Iran heads in a worse direction, does it temper his appetite for changing the government in Cuba? Probably not. I think the president realizes he has a lot of latitude in foreign policy. And even if there's pressure on Donald Trump after the midterms because the Democrats take control of the House and cut down the margin in the Senate, I still think this is going to be a prize of the administration because Marco Rubio doesn't want to leave office without fomenting some kind of change there, given that he now has the opportunity.
And finally, what does the Trump administration's endgame look like in the Western Hemisphere, not just with regard to the Latin American countries or Cuba or Venezuela, but all of the Western Hemisphere, so including obviously Canada and up to Greenland as well? What would it need to achieve and accomplish for it to believe that its mission is complete?
Security and stability in Mexico. It's one of the countries, we're not here to talk about Mexico today, but Mexico is the most important country to the United States. We'll see how the renegotiation of USMCA goes. But for the United States, security and stability in Mexico is the number one priority because it's a location of the top foreign terrorist organizations, the Sinaloa cartel that's fomenting disorder throughout the region, but also in Europe, primarily the narcotics that come in to France and Belgium. And beyond that, it's building this multinational coalition, the Shield of Americas, which has a diplomatic and military component. I think it's strengthening trade deals. It's building a hemispheric-wide critical minerals sector. The administration is really trying to claw back some hemispheric-wide autonomy on critical minerals, perhaps even trying to build processing plants. There's going to be further economic integration. I think we'll see in the coming months a more deployment of capital through the Development Finance Corporation to try to increase investments to provide a credible financial alternative to the Chinese Communist Party, to build a legacy initiative. And I'm still interested to see what that is that lasts beyond the Trump administration. So it's about hemispheric defense. It's about integrating economies. It's about building a North American fortress against China. And it's really about resolving the China problem in Latin America, which sounds like a tall order in the next 3 years. But given the trends in Latin America, they are cutting Trump's way. He has to be the luckiest man that's ever been president.
And I mean, just listening to you speak there, this sounds like a vast undertaking. And as you say, it probably will take more than one presidency, perhaps even two presidencies, to accomplish this vision for the Western Hemisphere. Do you think we are dealing with a shift in American foreign policy that will transcend Trump himself and will even transcend the Republican Party? Is this something that is just going to be the new normal in American politics now?
Well, I would hope so. Historically, it has been. We talk a lot about the Monroe Doctrine, which is somewhat of a pejorative for a lot of Americans and Latin Americans, for that matter. But the outlier has been recently, administrations being more transatlantic in orientation. And yes, I realize the irony of mentioning that here in London, but throughout America's history, for various reasons, American policymakers have always looked to the Western Hemisphere. And even now, it makes complete strategic sense. Our two largest trading partners are in the Western Hemisphere, our social and political and family connections. And also, as I alluded to, the solutions to our China problem are in the Western Hemisphere. And here's why I hope it becomes a bipartisan issue. Of course, there are going to be fierce disagreements about policy in the Western Hemisphere, particularly towards transnational criminal organizations and the way that's playing out in this administration versus what a Democratic president would pursue. But the idea about providing a credible financial alternative is a bipartisan initiative. When I was in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Appropriations Committee last year, that was the top issue that both Democratic senators and Republican senators wanted to know about. It was, how do we catalyze the power of American capital to confront the Chinese Communist Party? I think that will continue to be a bipartisan initiative. Reshoring, nearshoring, having resilient supply chains, critical minerals, finding rare earths, on and on and on. So I think on the economic side, that's where the bipartisanship will continue. Whereas on the security side, I think there's going to be deep divisions between Republican and Democratic presidents about what that looks like. But some of it will continue. I mean, the law enforcement connections have been the same throughout administration, and capacity building and intelligence sharing. But in terms of using lethal force against drug cartels, I think I'm less inclined to say that a Democratic president would continue that. But you never know. Plan Colombia was a Bill Clinton initiative that George Bush continued. So,
Joseph, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.